Senator Stedman, Vice Chair Bishop, and myself, Chair Tuck, and we do have a quorum to do business. I also want to thank Lori Rowland from Records and Johan Timmers in the Anchorage and Doug Bridges in Juneau for the Legislative Information Office.
Sorry,
and also joining us is Representative Josephson and Senator Hoffman. We will have to get a... There we go. We're looking good. Looking good. Okay, the first order of business is the approval of minutes. Vice Chair Bishop.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I move that the Legislative Budget Audit Committee approve the minutes of the November 6th, 2020 meeting as presented.
Hearing no objection, the minutes from November 6th, 2020 meeting are approved. Our next order of business is to go into executive session to consider the final release of the following audits. The Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives, Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program Eligibility, and Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program Transportation Costs. Also, to consider the preliminary release to the departments of the following audit: the Office of Child Services Compliance with the Foster Care Reform Laws, Part 1. Vice Chair Bishop.
Chairman, I move that the Legislative Budget Audit Committee go into executive session under Uniform Rule 22B3, discussion of matters that may, by law, be required to be confidential. I ask that the following persons remain in the room or on the phone lines: the Legislative Auditor and necessary staff for the Auditor, the Legislative Legal Services Director Megan Wallace and necessary legal staff, services staff, any legislators not on the committee, and staff or legislators who are members of the committee.
There being no objection, we will go into executive session after brief ADs to clear the room and phone lines, but I also want to recognize that we have Representative Johnston on the line with us, and she started with us at the beginning. With that, we'll take an ADs to secure the room.
All right.
Legislative Budget and Audit Committee will come back to order. Present, we have Representative Foster, Representative Josephson, Representative Sponholz, President Giesel, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Hoffman, Senator Stedman, Vice Chair Bishop, myself, Chair Tuck, and online with us, we have Representative Johnston, we have Senator Wilson, Senator Keough, Representative Edgman, and Representative Stutes, who all joined us during the executive session as well. Our next order of business is we'll be entertaining two motions today, one for the final releases and one for a preliminary release. Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the following audits be released as final public reports: Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives, number two, Department of Health and Social Services, Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program Eligibility, and Department of Health and Social Services, Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program Transportation Costs.
There being no objections, the audits are released. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I move the following preliminary audit be released to the agencies for response: Department of Health and Social Services, Office of Children's Services, Compliance with Foster Care Reform Laws, Part 1.
There being no objections, the preliminary audit will be released to the agencies for response. Our next item on today's agenda is to take up a special audit request by Representative Sponholz and myself regarding the Department of Revenue Oil and Gas Tax Audit Process. And if I may, I'm going to have my staffer, Ken Alper, come to the table to present the audit to the committee. And then we also have our auditor here for us to take on any questions that we may have. Feel free, Ken.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I hope you don't mind that I've unmasked myself, as did the prior speaker, for ease of communication. For the record, my name is Ken Alper, staff to Chairman Tuck in the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. and I'm here to introduce the special audit request you will find in your packet, as well as the memorandum of the request itself, two documents. One of them is the two-page executive summary from the 2014 special legislative audit of the oil and gas production tax structure, and an 11-page document that's a letter. The cover letter is to the co-chairs Stedman and Von Imhoff, Senate Finance, from the Department of Revenue with some information from January 2019 that we're looking to get updated with this special audit request. I'll be referring possibly to some of the information in those documents if we have some discussion and follow-up questions. For background, in the past year, the Tax Division refused to provide Ms. Curtis, the legislative auditor, some of the information she's statutorily allowed to get, specific to assessments, settlements, that sort of thing. That led to there being a qualified opinion, an asterisk in the statewide single audit because of a lack of complete information coming from the Department of Revenue. In addition, there have been some requests for information that have been denied from individual legislators on the grounds that it was confidential. That is the sort of information that in past years has been not considered confidential, and in fact, there are specific statutory exceptions to that data being confidential, meaning aggregated data within the production tax. To the extent that any follow-up questions as I walk through the request speak to the single audit and the qualified opinion is when I'm going to call up Ms. Curtis as a lifeline, because she clearly knows a lot more about that than I do. So the questions being asked in this are really in three broad categories. The first couple of them are really updating the data in the 2014 legislative audit. So we want to make sure that the production tax audit staff and workloads are appropriate, that they have the right number of people and they're adequately trained for the job, and that they have appropriately adapted to the advanced software that was, in 2014, still a work in progress, but has been fully implemented and is part of their world. That project was funded in the FY 2012 capital budget, $34.7 million. So we're also looking at the process itself. Have they changed anything and how they go about the audits and what are their priorities? And then are there changes in their policy? Are they reinterpreting any statutes? Is anything being considered differently? Are there things that we used to consider a taxable entity that no longer is? Has something changed in the way that they are collecting the tax, specifically in the last couple of years? The next broad subject area is the information that was missing in the statewide single audit, and now we're really at numbers 4 and 5 on the audit request memo. There was a question of whether tax audit assessments may have been paid using tax credit certificates. As you're all aware, there's a large overhang of unpurchased tax credit certificates that in the past the state used to buy as quickly as they came in. They're now $700 and some million outstanding. There was some concern that a major producer that might have a tax audit assessment might be purchasing those credits and using it to pay their taxes. There's no proof of this, but there's also no information to show that it's not being done, which is where Ms. Curtis's concerns were. And were that to take place, there's a constitutional issue. And the reason for that is the Supreme Court has determined that a production tax audit assessment is an administrative proceeding, the result of which has to go into the Constitutional Budget Reserve. That's the plain reading of the Constitutional Budget Reserve language in the Constitution. So if a tax audit is being paid for with tax credits, which is a general fund revenue source, it would be an unconstitutional diversion of money from the Constitution, from the Constitutional Budget Reserve without a three-quarter vote, and that would be problematic. So we need to find out if that sort of thing is taking place. The missing piece that Ms. Curtis hasn't been provided access to are really a lot of the audit settlement memos. When there's a dispute and the dispute is resolved and there's some sort of a payment, there's a formal process with a legal memo signed by the Commissioner of Revenue. Those were not being made available to the legislative auditor, so she could not get enough information to resolve that. There's also questions of whether taxes are being refiled or settled in advance of a formal audit assessment request. In that case, also trying to work around the CBRF issue and try to get certain assessment monies into the general fund. So we need to find out if any side deals are being made, if any settlements are being informally made that aren't part of the process to avoid administrative proceeding designation. The last series of questions on the memo, numbers 6 and 7, have to do with specific data coming out of the Department of Revenue, but more involves numbers. So although the individual taxes and individual tax assessments on a particular taxpayer is clearly confidential, this is IRS rules, state rules, there are exceptions in statute, specifically AS 4355-890, that allow for aggregated information. If there's at least three taxpayers, at least three data points, we are allowed, the administration is allowed to share with the public and the legislature the total. That keeps individual data confidential, and here we're talking about taxes, lease expenditure data, lots of specific data about the oil and gas operations and spending can be released in an aggregated form. We have information on total tax assessments for every audit cycle going back to at least 2000. From 2000 to 2007, the legislative auditor published in the 2014 special audit what the sum total was. We've completed the 2003 audits. We had $74 million or whatever the number was. We continue that process. I was the tax director for some of this time period, and every time a tax audit cycle would be completed, we would put out a memo that said we've completed the 2008, 9, 10, 11 audit cycle. The total amount assessed was X dollars plus this much interest equals that. So we have a complete data set up through 2012. In the last 2 years, the Department of Revenue has completed the 2013 audit cycle and may have completed the 2014. As of several months ago, they said they were close and has declined to share the information on total audit assessments, saying that that's confidential information. So the item 6 seeks to get that information from the Department of Revenue. Item 7 seeks to update the sort of information that was in that memo or referred to earlier that said of the assessed dollars, how much remains outstanding and in what category are they? Are these items that are in the appeals process? Are these items that have been elevated to the Office of Administrative Hearings? Is anything in court? Now, Representative Story, who made some of these requests, got an email from the Department of Revenue in October that said there are no audit, there are no outstanding assessments through 2013, period. Now, that was surprising information. There's a small error in the document in front of you, number 7. It refers to $1.3 billion in open assessments. That $1.3 billion includes some assessments that had previously been paid. The real number through 2012 is about $900 million. There's about $900 million of what was known unpaid assessments outstanding as of January 2019. Plus, there's the unknown number that came in for the 2013 cycle. So $100, $200 million most likely based on recent activity. So there's $1 billion or so worth of outstanding audited assessments that are no longer pending. In some way, they have been settled or resolved, which then leads to, well, what happened? Without the auditor having access to the settlement memos, we don't know what happened. The only thing we could piece together is what we know as money that went into the Constitutional Budget Reserve. The Constitutional Budget Reserve data exists in two different forms. You could see the total number in the Revenue Sources book. That number includes money coming in from multiple sources, royalty audits, oil property tax, corporate income tax, mining taxes, as well as the oil and gas production tax. The Department of Revenue puts out an annual report that, to the extent they can, breaks that out by source. So for 2019, the annual report is complete, and we know that $166 million resulting from the production tax went into the CBRS. For FY20, the annual report isn't out yet, but we know from this Revenue Sources book that $235 million total went to the CBRF, some large portion of which would have come from the production tax. So we've got a universe of something approaching but not quite $400 million that likely came from production tax settlements out of $1 billion worth of original audits. So the last part of this request is to try to find out what happened. Was there a change in policy? Was there a master settlement across the board? You know, why is it that all of these audits may have only been settled for 35, 40 cents on the dollar? And that, Mr. Chairman, is the nuts and bolts of what the request is before you, and I'm happy to answer any follow-up questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Alper, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Alper, why do we think that the administration would respond to this audit any differently than how they've responded to Ms. Curtis in recent years?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you have to ask first. Hopefully this doesn't need to become more contentious. I'm not inside the process. The process of the legislative auditor working with the departments is confidential, and we don't have access to that. According to the single audit, they refused the information claiming confidentiality. With the more formal process of a special audit, hopefully that might shake something loose over there. If not, it might have to get more adversarial, but we hope it doesn't go that way.
Any further questions? Senator Stedman. Auditor. Okay. Make sure I place this real quick.
Okay. I see how they're doing that.
Senator Stedman.
Chairman, you know, since this issue has come to light several months ago, it has definitely been an area of concern. And my understanding is the you are the auditor for the state, correct?
Good idea.
Through the chair, yes, I'm the legislative auditor.
Legislative auditor, and this department comes under your purview. You're their auditor also?
Through the chair, my position is a constitutional position, and by statute I have access to all information, including that it was as confidential.
And you, in your office, on numerous occasions, held into confidential data that is still held confidentially, but that allows you to do your job as an auditor, correct?
It is correct.
Mr. Chairman, I expect this to get elevated. My concern is the old cockroach theory. Something that shows up, cockroach runs around the floor, you put a hole in the wall and the wall's full of it. That's my concern. And I'd like to know if there's a refusal to allow our auditors to know what's going on in our own departments, what is the next step that we would take to protect the integrity of the financial information that the legislature and the public has preview to?
Let's take it as a rhetorical question, but that's a good question.
That's a direct question.
To the chair, most of the issues that we're dealing with has to do with whether information we're asking for is privileged information. This particular administration has denied us access based on whether information is privileged, where we have not had that issue in the past administrations. So that is, they claim that information that we would need in order to answer some questions, we can't have because that's attorney-client privileged. Those are the types of things we're going to have to figure out in this process.
Follow up?
That's the goal. If they continue to hold the line of refusing access, what's our next step to ensure that we have a review of basically the books to make sure that they're clean and street language?
Through the chair, this committee does have subpoena power, and whether it gets litigated to some other higher entity to say whether something is or is not allowed for me to look at. But to my knowledge, this committee has never exercised its power. So that's hopefully we can work together to come to some understanding of what is or is not within my purview. Or the legislature can specifically state that I have access to privileged information as part of the statute. That is another option.
Mr. Chairman, my concern is there's nobody watching the hen house, and we're dealing with hundreds of millions, in fact, in this industry, billions. of credits over the years, and it's significant in any measurement. And the public and the legislature needs to have a high comfort level that these transactions are documented and justified in proper form and reported within our financial statements, so we as policymakers can understand the benefits and possible pitfalls in any policy that we pursue. I think this is a significant issue, Mr. Chairman, and unfortunately, it's push might come to shove. So my comfort level isn't high when we can't even get the auditors to review stuff. So if you're not allowed to review it, who reviews it for the departments?
Through the chair, if you're talking about the tax credits themselves, we can review what's in the accounting system. We do look at documents associated with the tax credits that they believe are not privileged. So we do have some understanding of what's in the financial statements. In FY19, they weren't allowing us access to their subsystem, and when we asked for specific information to follow up on the assessment issue, they were not responsive. That led to a qualification. We are still in progress for the FY20.
When we, Mr. Chairman, have I got?
Yes.
I don't want to word this one. How is the public assured that there is no interconnections or has not been any quid pro quo when we deal with settlements of credits and basically with the settlement of credits without an audit?
I think that's what this audit can provide. Assurance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the questions. Senator Von Imhoff.
So I think what's important to me is, as you do this audit, is to look at the flow of cash. And when you do look at certificates, please provide cash value, as in if there was a certificate being used for a tax payment, let us know what the two cash values, if they were like a net transaction. Does that make sense? Or am I asking the wrong thing?
Through the chair, are you asking for if the credit was, say, $100?
Yes.
You want to know what the state paid for it, whether it was 80 cents on the dollar,
yes.
Or is that what you're asking?
I think what I guess what I'm asking is if I want to know the most important thing of them all is the flow of cash. Where did cash go in? Where did cash go out, and where did it go? And Mr. Alper was talking so fast. Unfortunately, he said a lot. I tried to follow along, and I just my interest was there was cash going in different accounts, and I know you had talked about that even in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know where the cash flow went and what cash was left on the table, what was discounted, things of that nature. If I'm not asking the question right, maybe you and I can have a conversation later. But to me, Senator Stedman is talking about the accountability of the tax credits and having them being purchased on the market and or exchanged for tax payments. I am also interested in the cash flow.
Okay. I understand.
Okay. I got President Giso, Representative Josephson, Vice Chair Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. I'm just taking on to what Senator Stedman, his train of comments, questions, when he asks how the public will have the information they need, we are the public. We are elected by the public. And so the legislative branch represents the citizens. And certainly in the last 2.5 years, we've seen an erosion, I'll call it an erosion, of legislative authority on multi-levels. But back to this two-page request, just a couple things to point out. In item number 4, whether tax credits were used, I would remind you, and I see no reason why Department of Revenue isn't transparent about this, but in House Bill 111, that legislative intent was articulated, that credits could be used. Credit may be used to, quote, satisfy a tax, interest, penalty, fee, or other charge that hasn't been subject to an administrative hearing or litigation. There should be no reason that they aren't transparent about that. It was legislative intent. And then in number five, the last sentence talks about whether the state is entering into any form of agreement with a taxpayer outside of the audit assessment process. And that is something that, of course, we've allowed them to do. Mr. Alper issued two advisory documents during his time as the tax division director that resulted in a need for the companies to revise their tax filings. And so, again, that's happened before. It should be transparent information, but it's something to keep in mind. Sometimes reading some of these implies that taxpayers have been unscrupulous, and sometimes, frankly, it's allowed. So I just bring that up just as a modifying statement related to the questions. Mm-hmm. But I do share your concern that the legislative branch and the public are being pushed to the side. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sherman.
Thank you. Representative Josephson. Chair, Ms. Curtis, you indicated that there's a law that can be triggered, thought you said, where we bless or find that you are entitled to review privileged information. You said something like that. In other words, that we don't need a legal fix because we have a law that applies.
No, through the chair, I said one option would be to clarify my ability to look at privileged information by changing the law.
Yeah. Okay. Follow up. It strikes me, and I had a conversation about this earlier today, that a settlement memorandum, to the extent you could see it, it wouldn't likely talk about how a number was arrived. In other words, it's not likely to say, well, you asked for $100 million, but when we discussed this, we agreed that we would discount that by $30 million because our tariffs were greater, you know, the marine costs were greater than, and you seem to agree, that sort of thing. In other words, to really understand how a number was derived in the settlement, you'd have to talk to the right people, someone knows, or you'd have to do a very, very deep dive. Isn't that right? I mean, because the settlement memo would just say, this is it could be 20, 30 pages long, admittedly, but it's likely to say, this is a full and final settlement of this tax period to this tax period, and it would have all this other legal jargon, but it might not get into the merits of the dispute.
Through the chair, I think I understand what you're saying, that in order to evaluate it, what is happening, it would involve a deep dive into communications between the state and the auditee or the taxpayer. Yes, there would be a lot. It wouldn't be as simple. It's never as simple. An audit objective is rarely a simple case. It would involve looking at all the information available, and management would like to give a small slice. And from an audit perspective, we don't see the whole pie. We can't make it a judgment if we're only giving a little slice. We don't see the big picture.
Okay, I'm just thinking out loud about, since those are normally policy calls made by the executive branch, independent of the legislature, I mean, the public may say, we need a different sort of check, a different system, because you're selling these on the cheap or whatever. But I'm not sure quite what the remedy. Mr. Chair, can I ask Mr. Alper something?
Yes, feel free.
President Josephson. Mr. Alper, through the chair, President Diesel noted, and I hadn't thought about this for a long time, but that Senate Bill 111 allowed for some offsetting
And I'm not criticizing 111, but I am curious, is there a constitutional problem with 111 if the monies are supposed to go in the CBR?
Since my...
If 111 allows an offset to get to a net number, is that okay?
Right.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, thank you for asking, because it is an important clarification. And Senator Diesel referred to it when she was reading from the bill earlier. Yes, you can use tax credits to pay a tax obligation from a prior year, but only so long as that obligation would not have to go to the CBRS. So, which led to the question of, well, what would that be, for example? And which led down a further rabbit hole that took us to another qualified opinion earlier, which is, well, maybe a tax, an additional tax due to a tariff settlement, a change in transportation costs, maybe shouldn't be CBRS money. So there was a large FERC settlement that was pending at the time HB 111 passed. That led to several hundred million dollars of incremental taxes becoming due, and we thought perhaps that was the sort of thing that might be payable with tax credits. So when we were working with Senator Diesel on that bill, the goal was to help create what we were calling a secondary market for tax credits. We needed to find a way, with the state not providing the cash, that we would be able to allow these holders of credits to use them. One way would be to sell them. So we thought that perhaps these tariff settlements might be something outside the CBRS universe. That led to some reclassifying of previous deposits to the CBRS, which the ledge auditor found fault with, and there's about $1.2 billion in discrepancy outside of the scope of this audit, which it's not $1.2 billion in so-called real money. It's really in definition of how much we owe back to the CBRS, if that's all that it would really impact. But the key here, the short answer to your question is, yes, HB 111 allows us to go back in time, but only to the extent that the underlying obligation would not be CBRF revenue.
I'm just, if I might, hear, if there's some belief that, you don't mind pointing your microphone a little closer. There's some belief that an aggressive posture, which may have been overly aggressive, would have brought the state $1.1 billion, but we see indications that $400 million was paid. That's a $1,000 dividend, and the public may want to know about that. And, you know, the public may misunderstand that. It may be that the oil taxpayer arguments were, you know, we're good ones. I have no idea.
Chairman, yes. If I may. And I want to apologize to all members if I spoke too fast earlier. It's been a while since I've been before a committee, and it's in my nature sometimes. The total amount of assessment sounds quite large, and Senator Stedman talked about that, hundreds of millions of dollars. It's important to put in context just how large the oil and gas production tax is within the state of Alaska's overall revenue portfolio. It's traditionally our largest single revenue item, and I was looking at the numbers before. Between 2006 and 2012, which were the years that were open in the last memo you got, about $29 billion worth of production tax was collected by the state, all of the general fund revenue. The entirety of the audited assessments for those 7 years, including the amount that was paid before this memo was written, the stuff that was resolved in the past, is about $1.5 billion. So we're talking about an incremental 5% is what the Department of Revenue roughly found as far as unpaid taxes. But yet, that's enough money, as Representative Josephson said, that that equals $1,500 for every man, woman, and child in the state, you know, $1 billion outstanding. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to kind of put those numbers in perspective.
Thank you very much. Mr. Vice Chair Bishop. No, it's not a question, just a comment. We're not asking any more. Ms. Curtis is not asking any more or any less than what she's historically done. It's not a new day here, what we're asking. And the public, you know, we her,
questioning has been consistent, past practice, I think she should be afforded, and this committee should back her up to be afforded that information for the public.
Thank you for the comment. Any further questions? Okay. With that, I would like to entertain a motion. Mr. Vice Chair.
That the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee approve the request for a special audit of the Department of Revenue Oil and Gas Tax Audit Process made by Representatives Tuck and Sponholz.
Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing no objection, the committee has approved request for the audit of the Department of Revenue Oil and Gas Tax Audit Process. Yes, President Giesel.
Miss it. Have we approved the minutes which were item number 2 on the agenda?
Yes, we did. That was our first action. Yes, yes, we did.
Totally missed it. Okay, thank you.
All right, so that's fine. Is there a concern with the minutes? Okay, I just want to make sure because we can always rescind action if there's something we need to change. Okay, next order of business today are the governor's RPLs that was submitted to the committee by the administration on December 1st. We have Alexi Painter, who is our legislative fiscal analysis, that will brief the committee on the RPLs. He's online with us. In addition, we have representatives from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development and the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to answer any questions that we have along the way. Mr. Painter, can you hear us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. If you don't mind, go ahead and walk us through the first RPO.
For the record, Alexi Painter, and I'm the Legislative Fiscal Analyst. The first RPL is RPL number 08-2021-0278, the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. This is for $850,000 of federal receipt authority for market access program, federal carry forward, and for Cochrane missions. The U.S. Department of Agriculture makes an annual grant to ASME. In FY20, a portion of this grant went unspent due to the COVID-19 pandemic. So the USDA will allow ASME to carry forward the unspent portion of the grant, which is a bit under $800,000, into FY21. In addition, ASME anticipates up to 2 missions under the Cochrane Fellowship Program that's also funded by USDA. Those are a cost of about $60,000 each. ASME's existing federal receipt authority is insufficient for these awards, so they're seeking this RPL. Legislative Finance sees no technical issues with this RPL.
Any questions for Mr. Painter? Okay, hearing and seeing none. On to the next RPL, Mr. Painter.
Next one is RPL number 08-2021-0279 for the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. This is for $26,302 of federal receipt authority for oil field inspections and mechanical integrity testing. This one may look familiar to the committee because you approved a very similar RPL a year ago. This year, the AOGCC received a multipurpose grant from the EPA for the Underground Injection Control Program, and their existing federal receipt authority is insufficient to spend this grant. Once again, Legislative Finance sees no technical issues with this RPL.
Any questions on this RPO? We also have, I just want to point out, we have Chris Wallace from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission online. Are there any questions? Okay, hearing and seeing none. On to our next RPO, Mr. Painter.
Next one is RPL number 08-2021-0296, the Alaska Energy Authority. This one is for $3 million of federal receipt authority in the capital budget for the AEA Alternative Energy and Efficiency Program, specifically for the Five Mile Creek Hydroelectric Project. The Federal Denali Commission awarded a $3 million grant for this fund, or grant fund for this project. And the matching funds for this grant will be provided by $4 million from the Renewable Energy Grant Fund and then a $500,000 in-kind match from the Chitna Native Corporation. This RPL is attached to a capital project that was originally appropriated in FY13 for AEA's Alternative Energy and Efficiency Program. That original appropriation was not specific to one particular project, but covered a multitude of projects within this program. So this project would fit within the scope of that original capital project. Just a note about the timing on this one, the AEA has said that they anticipate that the project will close out in late 2022, so that takes us into fiscal year 23. However, there is an immediate need for the funding because they plan to begin design and permitting in February of 2021 and to select a contractor by April, so they would like to have the funds in hand. Once again, Legislative Finance sees no technical issues with this RPL.
We have a question from Representative Josephson. Mr. Josephson.
Through the Chair, Mr. Painter, in the late April, early May timeframe, there was some consternation about the legality of RPLs under the CARES Act. And what I learned at the time was that you had to have, if it was an operating budget item, in the current, essentially in the most recently passed budget, you had to have some linkage to a federal program. And, of course, that got litigated and then resolved by a bill approximately May 18th. And my question is, this is a capital project outside the five-year window or look back. Is there, and I'm not trying to create a firestorm, I'm just trying to educate myself. Is there a technical argument that this RPL is beyond the scope of what's acceptable or I guess, acknowledgeable or receivable by this body?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, while this project is originally from, 8 years ago at this point, the project is still active. The project, some of the other funds are still being actively spent, so it's an open project. The five-year window can be extended if projects are ongoing. So if it were an inactive project, I think we would have some consternation, but because there is still active activity on this project, it is an active going concern. And the reason they went back this far, we've actually appropriated funding to this Alternative Energy and Efficiency Program in subsequent years, but those subsequent years did not include Federal Receipt Authority. So by using the FY13 one, they were able to increase existing federal receipt authority in line with the statute. So we don't really have concerns, but we can see why it may raise some flags.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And I also want to point out that we have Michaela Fowler with Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development online, too, for any questions. Any further questions on this RPL? Hearing and seeing none. Mr. Painter, please lead us into the next one.
Okay, that takes us to RPL number 08-2021-0319. This is for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to receive about $2.5 million of federal receipts to increase community block grants for federal coronavirus community development block grants. The department received about $6.2 million for the community development block grants in the Federal CARES Act. The existing block grant appropriation had sufficient federal authority for the first two distributions of these funds, but not enough for the third distribution. So this RPL is for the third distribution in this amount. Legislative Finance does not have any technical issues with this RPL. We will assign our fund code 1265 to it, which is a federal fund code to enable tracking of COVID-19 appropriations.
Questions on this one? Hearing and seeing no questions, on to our last RPL.
So the last item is RPL number 07-2021-1173 for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development's Workforce Investment Board This one is for $2,190,200 of Federal Receipt Authority, and this is to cover existing grants that were covered in their operating budget, but for which they received additional grants beyond their expectations, or grant funding beyond their expectations. This is attaching to an operating budget item, and the Legislative Finance Division does not have any technical issues with this RPL.
Questions on this one? We do have Dan DiBartolo with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Open. Seeing no questions, that's the last of our RPLs. Thank you, Mr. Painter. Appreciate you walking us through that. And with that, Mr. Bishop, Mr. Vice Chair Bishop.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll start. I move that the Legislative Budget Audit Committee approve the following RPLs. And RPL number 08-2021-0278, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Market Access Program, Federal Carry Forward, and Cochrane Missions. RPL number 08-2021-0279, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Oil Field Inspections and Mechanical Integrity Testing. RPL number 08-2021-0296, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, AEA, Alternative Energy and Efficiency Programs, Five Mile Creek Hydroelectric Project in Chitna, Alaska. RPL 08-2021-0319, Department of Community, Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Additional Federal Authority for Community Block Grants. RPL number 07-2021-1173, Department of Labor, Workforce Development, Increased Federal Authority for Existing Grants.
Objection. That motion is approved. Committee has approved the RPLs on today's agenda. I don't see any. We don't have anything else on our agenda for today, but I just do want to say that I hope everybody has a safe holiday season and is able to spend some quality time with their family. I know these days of isolation is difficult, but please be safe out there. And with that, the committee is adjourned at 1:56 p.m. Thank you very much.